Trust me, there actually is a system.
Charge the ion accelerator. It's time to forge the narrative.
Hey everybody, welcome to Forge the Narrative. My name is Paul, your host, Wheel of All Souls Podcast. I'm joined tonight by Red Powell.
Hello.
And Adam Camilleri.
Good evening, everybody.
Welcome, everybody. Please like, share, and subscribe. We are a weekly show where we talk about Warhammer and Warhammer things.
Yeah. It's like the petroleum and petroleum-related products.
I think it's propane.
Propane. Oh, never mind. Ah.
Good try, though. Keep
Get the mwah-mwah out again. Get that out. We're starting off strong, guys.
So on this episode, I want to talk about gotcha moments, both in like gaming and then kind of segue into maybe another interesting topic. And then later on after the break, I want to talk about playtesting and constraints and maybe, you know, how to make more use out of your time in between tournaments and making sure you're considering all the factors.
Yeah, that's because the tournament season is starting to ramp up again. We're starting to get people going out and doing things, and the downtime, while still there, is not as extreme as it has been for like the last 12 months.
Yeah, and I even want to kind of touch on briefly like the terrain setup that is in the official Warhammer 40K Games Workshop tournament packet and how that differs from what we see in a lot of tables. So that's one constraint, making the most out of your play style is another constraint I want to talk about. But anyway, that's after the show. Let's talk about some gotcha moments.
Yeah, so I had a concept I wanted to put to Red, because for those who don't know, Red is quite a high-ranking gentleman in the U.S. Armed Forces, and a bit of a history of warfare and a student of history and a student of warfare, and I wanted to put to him the concept of gotcha moments in real-life battles. And I suppose coming from because I had this thought in the shower, as you do, you sit in your shower, you just lose time. I'm like, is gotcha the concept of that something that's exclusive to tabletop games? And I'm like, no, it definitely can't be. Is it something that's exclusive to, you know, gaming systems in general? Definitely not. Is it something that's just exclusive to humans or whatever? And where are the parameters? And does this stuff happen in real life? Is it part of the world? Is it part of life? And if it is, why should it be such a big deal that we get rid of it in the game if it is just a part of the world and part of how humans have been interacting with each other for years? So Red, yeah,
give us your thoughts. Definitely part of life. We got a trap card. I'm gonna play this face down card.
Yeah, so Adam, if you don't mind, because I'm very excited to talk about this topic, but Adam, could you talk about gotcha moments in 40K a little bit more, and then I will totally jump on this.
So gotcha moments is, I suppose, it's an interaction that one part of the two-player contract on a game of whatever tabletop game you want to be happened unawares. Like there was a negative reaction, something happened that was
unexpected event. So yeah, it doesn't necessarily have to have a negative connotation. I think that this is one of those things to where you know, did not expect the outcome or them to have something in their bag of tricks or whatever. And so it yielded an unexpected result, an outcome for you. Or for them, or whatever.
But generally, there is a stigma attached to it. There's a stigma of it was a negative interaction. If someone calls it a gotcha, it's almost getting a label the same as like whack, WWAC, as in, oh, you just gotcha'd me or gotcha'd because something happened that you were unaware of and didn't foresee or didn't plan for.
If you feel like, if you and I are playing and I feel like you have orchestrated some situation and led me down a path that had a different conclusion than maybe what we both thought about, that could be one of those negative gotcha moments.
Now, to put this into perspective, I think perfectly what Paul just said, a gotcha moment isn't that your opponent used a strat you weren't aware of. Expecting your opponent to explain to you all of their 30 stratagems and expecting you to retain the knowledge of all those 30 stratagems of not just your book, their book, and all the others, that's not a gotcha moment. A gotcha moment is more like what Paul just said. You have been steered into an interaction or a position on the board or on the table where something is going to occur that you could have prevented with full knowledge and ease of knowledge of, and your opponent orchestrated it to that result. That is more what we're talking about here. Sorry, Paul, did that give you the context you're talking of?
Oh, yeah, I definitely think that's right. Because, you know, there's things that are like, ah, of course, or, you know, bazinga or whatever. And then there's this whole intent. And I think that's maybe what we're talking about, or at least part of the context of what we're talking about.
Great. I think the context is absolutely applicable. I think it's great. I appreciate both of you guys jumping in to help kind of build the setting, because I really do think it's important. So with it, it's a very important concept, and it's not just in warfare, but for the game itself as well, because the context that we're discussing, it's also not, in my opinion, a situation where someone says, in our game that we're talking about, 40K here, or really any game, where someone says, well, do you have anything that can, if another player asks you, do you have anything that can interrupt combat or something outside of the basic stratagem? And if you, if you respond by saying no, but you actually do, that's not a gotcha deal in the same way that I think we're talking about it. That's just bad sportsmanship, right?
Agreed. Yeah.
And so I just want to kind of put that one off to the side, because those cases do happen, unfortunately. And we can talk another time about air guys and rumsucked and the human motivations as to why people do that, unfortunately. Sometimes people make mistakes and they forget. Sometimes that happens, but unfortunately it also happens intentionally. So I'm going to
deep in the tank and combing through your stratagems and discover something that even you had forgotten about.
Right. And it happens. And unfortunately, when that does happen and you realize you made a mistake like that, sure, that's going to create some feel bads. And I'll leave that up to other people's judgment in regards to like how they best use that, because you're going to probably need to buy somebody a hard drink after that in response, if you truly forgot that you had that, and then you find it and then you use it. Yeah, that's something else. So, but in the case of a gotcha moment of what you gentlemen discussed previously, so some parallels, it's not an exact parallel, but it does rhyme in this case of, think of like chess, right? And there are chess traps, and there are maneuvers, and there are things that a lot of people playing the game don't realize. You know, it's just like what you said, Paul, you start being ushered into something, and then before you know it, in a lot of cases, when you get into the higher up levels of chess, you can see these equations close in, because ultimately chess is a closed game, right? There's not, the board only goes so far. There's only so many models. They can only move in so many different variations. And the way it plays out over time, like it could only go so many ways. Our game, 40K, is a little more expanded in the regards that, we have, we're not bound to tiles. We don't have just specific movements in the same direction, but we do have, you can move this far, you can roll this many dice, so on and so forth. I do want to kind of break this into two parts. And one of those is the, what was discussed about, being able to understand and know things, and as far as like recall, understanding what's in the other person's army, understanding what's in your army, what you're capable of, what they're capable of, and the foresight and understanding of knowing what, what's ahead of you as far as that goes. That's one aspect of this. And so in that, I'm gonna refer to that as kind of the science of 40K, right? Of the game. And then on the other end, we're gonna talk about the art. There's a big point to this, and how you, because there is human engagement, right? And how you can gauge dealing with another person and their awareness and your awareness and things like that. How many times in chess do you watch competitive chess players say, nope, you don't want to do that because you're going to make this mistake? How many times do they do that in competitive matches?
I don't see it. Yeah, they wait for them to just lie in wait.
They do. They just sit there and watch. And there's a whole other element, just like poker, of sitting across the table from another person. And there is a match of wills, which is like the most basic definition of war in and of itself, is a duel of wills, right? It's willpower. And so that's where I'm going to look more at this art aspect to it. And so when we go back to the science, when you take science and art in mind, that you put those two together, and that is warfare, right? And so we look at the science aspect, and it's really hard because you get in these situations, and there absolutely is a good person aspect to sportsmanship in 40K. And there are a lot of people in cases where, even myself, I've been on the giving and receiving end of this, of helping another player or being helped myself, and reminder of rules and abilities and capability into it, to a point that's where we break from some of the chess aspects. But at the same time, some of these things you just don't really understand until you've either you've either seen it play out, which is some of the benefit of watching, like, you know, battle reports and things like that, or you've been on the receiving end and you see it happen to yourself, right? Being like real life experience is one of those real things, in my opinion, that it's very hard to simulate otherwise. And so that's where, for some folks, I totally understand if you're one of those that's out there and battle reports don't do it for you, but playing the game in most cases will, right?
A great example of what you're talking about is, I think, Soulburst. If you try to get a relatively new player, and back when Soulburst was, you know, the extra move, extra fight, extra psychic, whatever you wanted it to be, this is talking about 3 or 4 years ago now, but trying to explain that to a new player, just being like, okay, so there's this thing that one section of the factions has that completely breaks all the rules. They just get to do a whole new thing again. And trying to explain that, how to navigate it, how to get around it, would have just been an absolute nightmare back then. Thank God I wasn't creating content back then, so I could dodge that bullet. Probably didn't. But I think, is that a good example of what you're talking about?
Yes, I think that's a great example. For me, I totally understand it more so in the exact same context of Soulburst as Berserkers Fight Twice, right?
Yeah.
So trying to explain to folks that Berserkers don't just attack twice. It's not just double their number of attacks. It's that Berserkers pile in, roll their dice to for their attacks, consolidate, and then, especially if they charged against a unit that didn't charge or doesn't have the ability to intervene, and then the Berserkers get to do it all over again, which is pile in, attack twice. And so I will say, unfortunately, I think Berserkers and Soul Bursting is a great example as well, that can induce a gotcha moment or the feeling of a gotcha moment simply because of the science behind the mechanic. And it's not something that a lot of people think about in some regards until it happens to them. And when it dawns on them of how it's going down, it does cause some bad feelings because you didn't see it coming. And the other case is that there are a lot of times in the game and the structure of it and our sportsmanship where it is something to explain things, right? It is something, but there's also, it's a very fine line of tact and human engagement, in my opinion, of being able to navigate where and when is the right time to coach and help the other player, and also be competitive and understand when, I mean, if someone asks, I think you should be totally forthcoming.
I think that's exactly right. And also, when there's a fundamental thing about the game, like engagement range, as a for instance, you know, how things have different vertical versus horizontal engagement range. And if you see an opponent making a mistake like that, or setting themselves up for something they didn't intend, is that a time to maybe say something? Are we trying to coach sportsmanship here? Or are we coaching avoiding gotcha? I mean, I don't know what.
So I think that there's a tactful approach to it, that it does take a, in my opinion, an experienced and practiced judgment of an individual to know when is the time to do it one way or the other, and how to go about it appropriately. And because, again, when you're playing competitive chess, for example, you don't tell someone that, like, oh, hey, if you go here, I'm going to do this.
Yeah, I got you in two moves.
If you do this. Yeah. Exactly. Like, no one's going to say, don't do that because it's checkmate in three turns.
That does happen in the TV shows. Probably not so much in actual competitive chess.
Sure.
It happens in the anime and the Yu-Gi-Ohs and the...
But that's the thing, though, is that, so going back to this, and I'm just, I mean, I haven't even got into real conflict, right?
Yeah.
We haven't even gotten into the heart of what you were getting at, Adam. I'm just talking about the game itself. And there's so much to that in building as we head into the real life concept of this, is that when you come to the concept of warfare, the art aspect is such a big concept, in my opinion, in regards of being able to read other people, right? There's some Sun Tzu elements. There's more than just the physical aspect. Don't get me wrong. One of my favorite quotes, if logistics was easy, they would call it operations, which into the importance of the science behind making a military action occur and all that goes into supporting it versus
burn.
Actually executing. Sorry, what'd you say, Paul?
I said, that's a sick burn.
Oh, man. But it's a real thing, right? I mean, it was Napoleon who said that tactics are for amateurs, logistics are for professionals. Mm-hmm. And so
an army marching on his belly and all that stuff. And if you don't have the proper support, you don't have an army, and yeah.
Right, and so that goes into the science of it, right? And so when we take that from the actual action into the game concept, understanding, like we were talking about, engagement ranges, movement, the volume of dice and the mechanics that go into it, the synergy that you can create between stratagems and units' special abilities and the exceptions therein. Some units have very tricky exceptions that can also create into those gotcha moment kind of deals that, you know, if you don't know about that unit specifically, it can do this versus that. And so there's all these little pieces of science, and it's a real thing when you take into account that you know, Warhammer 40K has 15 plus factions. And the rules are perpetually updating. And every time an FAQ comes out, if you're not tracking every single thing, you know, it can throw you off here or there. And so there is a science to that. And there's also to a degree, you know, that given it is a game, there's a science to the translation of the verbiage to a certain extent, right? And understanding, we've talked some about rules as written versus rules as intended, and the way the game goes, you know, was the succubus meant to have infinite attacks? Like, no, of course not. Those kinds of things. The science that goes to it. Now, the art part goes back to that judgment of being able to understand when is the right time to push and when is the right time to pull, when is the right time to pull back and realize, like, okay, there's more to this game than necessarily just winning the tactical victory, but establishing a broader victory by, like, what are we really doing here? Why are we really playing the game? If you can't find anybody to play because no one wants to play with you, like, how enjoyable is the game really in and of itself? And we've seen up to the highest levels of competitive nature that people are known for being good or bad players in a lot of regards. And so, like, the art of engagement and being a person and engaging in this community-based game absolutely has its place. And so when it goes to this gotcha deal, so without jumping too far, limited warfare versus the concept of total warfare, right? So just like, and I don't mean to draw too many parallels with chess at this point because we're about to step into big areas, limited warfare was very much this controlled objective, right? So Frederick the Great, the Prussian king, he just wanted Silesia. He didn't want to take over all of Europe like his you know, predecessors well down the road with Germany. He just wanted Silesia, and he needed it to do this, this, and this. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, when you go into but he did it, and he did it preemptively, right? He did attack preemptively. And then the whole 7-year war deal, he did it preemptively under the assumptions that the other people were going to attack. And so there was a reading on a massive political scale that our game is just a silly reiteration of to the smallest degree. And so, you know, do you have limited objectives? Do you have total objectives? So when you go total war, we're talking about the complete, absolute commitment of all of your resources to the execution of warfare. And that's a Klaus Witzian deal. And it is a theoretical concept. No one ever can achieve the absolute total war of committing everything because your willpower and your friction just won't allow it. And so when it goes into this gotcha deal, at what point do you really find yourself holding back when you've committed to total war? And I think that I'll be honest, in some cases of the competitive element, again, it goes back to that judgment point. I would argue that you can't really go to the extent of total war in 40K because of all of the other elements and the complexities therein. I think every game of 40K should arguably, I mean, to one degree or another, be limited war, if you want to call it that, duel of wills, because there are more aspects to the game than just winning. But that doesn't mean that you can't go into the game, have a good time, have a challenging competitive occasion with another person, and not have honestly outplayed them. It's okay. Yeah. Like, it's absolutely okay to have outplayed someone. And I understand where that might seem like where we've gone with gotcha moments, and that because you hate it that someone walked into it to a certain extent. But at the same time, it is a game and it is a war game, and people do that. And in real world circumstances, we set ambushes, and when it comes down to matters of survival and everything, we still, like, when I say limited, there's still rules of law of land warfare. There's the rules of escalation, the ROE. There's all these other things that balance out. There's, you know, do we have the appropriate and discriminate uses of force and things like that, that don't allow us to just go all, you know, we're not, there's a reason why we don't all just use nukes, right?
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
There's absolutely
right.
ways to go about it. But at the same time, we do put people in, we do ambush people. It does happen. It is a tactic. Catching people by surprise is absolutely a thing. And I have talked more than my mount there.
You've encapsulated it really well. I want to talk to some specific examples soon, but I want to call back to when I think gotcha moments really became prevalent for us in 8th edition. That was the release of the Genestealer Cult Army, which to a lot of intents and purposes functioned off gotcha moments, as in it had so many moving parts and so many abilities to
blips,
redeploy.
Yeah,
exactly. Right. Yep. Redeploy, charge, pop up 3 inches away, double shoot, you know, go back into the shadows, all these things. And if you had a whiteboard with, you know, just underlying all the plays as they were most likely to happen, sure, you were fine into Genestealer Cult. You built for them, you took the right amount of screens and these little things to punch them out, you know, Auspex scanned them when they came in, et cetera, and then of course Infiltrators came in, and the whole thing was a moot point. But prior to that, there was this time where we had a full faction that in some ways functioned off the disparity in knowledge between what you're playing to do and what your opponent thinks is possible. And I feel like that was where we kind of needed to have a universal opinion on what is and isn't a gotcha moment. Like, you can't call what GSC used to do a gotcha moment. It's just what the army was built to do. And they, as much as they need to tell you that what are the possibilities, they don't need to tell you what the playbook is, so to speak. I mean, sure. Another one, a great example would be American football, right? You guys would probably be able to tell me more than that, but you guys put great stock in playbooks and, you know, play-by-plays and things like that, and, you know, running back XYZ play a million times at nauseam, so the guys on the field do it at a split second without thinking. You know, get in the opposition's playbook, you know what these players are capable of doing. You know, you've got the stats, you've got their heights and weights and their abilities and their past games.
Realistically, as soon as someone runs a certain direction, they call a certain code word or whatever, then you're able to key in on that stuff. They bank on the fact that one cannot do that, and so that is a trick play or whatever, you know.
I wanted to ask Red if he knew. I got an example of a real life gotcha moment, a warfare gotcha moment, being the Battle of Agincourt, where it was a super. A massively superior, both armed and numerous French force versus, you know, Henry, was it Henry the Conqueror? I can't remember.
Henry the Fifth, yep.
Henry the Fifth, yeah. And he had a much smaller, you know, disease-ravaged army, but that army consisted of 80% of British, English longbowmen. And that was essentially almost unheard of up until that point, having that density of that heavy firepower. And because of that, like, swathes of fully mounted plate knights went down when usually they were this indestructible unit. They're essentially like Terminators of that, you know. And all of a sudden this guy was like, well, 80% of my army is plasma guns, so your Terminators mean squat. And it was a real big turning point in the history of both nations and the history of the world. Are you able to extrapolate on that, some more of these real life instances?
Sure. No, I mean, and I think, like, drawing folks into it, right? So think of the Operation Bagration, right? Are you familiar with it, Paul?
No.
Adam?
No idea.
Okay. So World War II, it is the Eastern Front for the Germans. And so the Russians versus the Germans are the Soviets. And so the Soviets versus the German army, the Soviets are actually through Belarus, are going to deceive the Germans. And the way they go about it is this massive deception operation, to the extent that they committed forces in one area, they hid all of their movement of forces in another area. And so when we talk about in our game, you know, as I've talked about before, 40K on the table is very much a small unit tactic kind of game. The limitations of it and the ranges and everything in proportion, you can have a lot of models, but at the same time, it's still just very limited tactics. But the scope of what the Soviets were able to accomplish in Bagration, where really, I mean, they moved in divisions of capability into this area where the Germans definitely did not think they were going to go. The Germans recommitted elsewhere. And then overnight, the Russians were able to launch an attack that on June 23rd, you know, just a few, we're only just barely a week past it, actually. The Russians totally overwhelmed the central army of the Germans and just totally wiped them out, caught them off guard. They completely did not expect the scope or the capability that the Soviets had. And so, you know, I mean, can you blame them, right? Like, can you hold that against them when it comes down to it? And this what they were trying to accomplish, the willpower behind it, right? This duel of wills, and can you read them correctly versus can you not? I mean, another aspect using World War II, the Allied invasion into North Africa, right? And where the it wasn't so much of a feint. There were elements of it. You could say that greater feint, probably Operation Overlord with Normandy. But when it comes to North Africa, so take an army, not so much necessarily deception. I mean, there were elements of it. But okay, here's the weakest part of where my enemy is. And I'm going to commit everything against that part to such an extent that I can take that to create a position of relative advantage and a position to build from where then I can continue the rest of my operation, right? And so like the discussion between the Allied forces, which was so like, you know, we're talking Stalin and Churchill and Roosevelt at this time still. And so those three, I mean, the Western Allied powers told Stalin that they were going to do this at this given point. And Stalin said, I'm going to do this at this certain point. And so Stalin held up his end, and that, you know, falling through with Bagration and everything. And then what the Western Allies did coming through Northern Africa, I mean, they completely disabled what the Germans had there, and then were able from there to push forward to Italy and then push forward into the southern part of Europe. And then you go into Normandy. Like, so at what point are you going to say in the scope of warfare, and we're talking world warfare, which had surpassed all extents of warfare, at what point are you going to say that wasn't fair? Right.
Fair is actually a very charged word. So that word, it means something different with the context that you use it in. And this is something in in business. And often in business, if someone says, oh, you're not being fair or whatever, they potentially mean something else. It's something when you hear that word, you actually should kind of go on high alert.
Sure. Absolutely. Exactly. And that's where it comes to some of this with as it translates, you know, so I just gave a couple examples, you know, going back to Henry V, I mean, using what you have available to make it work, right? And we've talked about, I mean, by no means, in my opinion, are the world eaters and corn-based armies the most competitive, right? You still show up to the table with the same amount of points as the other person. But I think we can agree that almost like in technological advancements and evolution, like the new codexes definitely have some advantages to them. I'm not saying that 2,000 points of Chaos Space Marines or Khorne altogether don't have some advantages, but there are improvements to some of the newer material that's coming out. And so, I mean, again, like, for example, like 2-wound Space Marines versus 1-wound Space Marine, I'll can't fail to bring that up. But at the same time, though, there are advantages to be taken, and you've got to find the terrain, right? You go to Henry V and determining that the muddy terrain, although you were going to commit and you were going to lose, and so understanding risk and opportunities that went into it, I was going to risk this much at the expense of this in order to achieve this opportunity. Operation Bagration with the Soviets, if they'd been exposed, there was opportunity that the Germans might have been able to respond with greater force where the deception was projected to occur, and that might have done just that much more damage. It might have made it that much more of a slugfest, whereas it didn't, so therefore the Soviets were able to just steamroll through them. There's all kinds of aspects to it that you can go what if and whatnot, and you can look at, well, should it have been like this, or should they have given them a chance, so on and so forth. But when it comes down to it, in a lot of cases, and that's where a huge differentiating factor between the war games and the actual war scenario is that, like, I think that there is something awesome in accomplishing actual surprise through audacity in a lot of cases, in both war and war games. But I also think that when it comes to the war games, you have to underline, highlight, italicize, and make like three sizes bigger the word game in it. And so there's absolutely an aspect to it that you're coming back to play games with more people and not just any one given instance in which your life depends upon it.
Yeah, exactly right. And that's true. And I suppose that comes back to a lot of definition of, you know, a lot of people like to see Warhammer as, you know, somewhere close to a sport, not quite, you know, like a tennis or rugby game or anything like that, but so a competitive exchange in some case, especially at a tournament, a competitive exchange of wits, of minds, of models, of tactics. And yeah, there has to be some kind of mutual respect there, because you know, the whole thing is built upon repeat entries. You know, this is a crappy thing to say, I would treat people differently across the table if I knew I didn't have to coexist in a community with them, e.g. what actual warfare is. It is a bold statement, but you know, that whole contract we have is about community growth and community progression. If there was no community, why would there be investment? Why would there be incentives for us to care about each other's feelings? And which is something I care about deeply. I truly and always work towards my opponent having just as much fun winning or losing as I have winning or losing, and that result should not matter for that outlook as well.
Sure. So when it comes down to it, right, the way we know that our war game is totally something else outside of a life or death scenario is a perfect example from we'll call it a historical vignette of Warhammer 40K. a few years ago, you've got two players, very competitive, headed into, I mean, they're up there and they're headed into the finals. They're not there yet, but this is definitely a major game. You've got two players. You've got one player who is deploying, or they're in their movement phase, and they go to deep strike a unit, and they put this unit down, and they're asking questions of their opponent, like if it's good. And then they realize that they deployed that unit and they put it down and they've stepped away from it, and they go into, they thought they were going to transition, but then they realize that they hadn't moved the rest of their army. And unfortunately, when they turn to the other player across the table, right, this is not an opponent, this is not a life or death scenario, whatever, there literally nothing else has been done. The opponent turns and says, no, you have now deep struck that unit. You cannot move anything else. That's it. And I'd like to say with some hyperbole that the entire Warhammer 40K world was watching. And so this is where I go into this limited versus total war, because the person who made the mistake more or less said, and good on him for not just sitting there and taking it either, because I don't think he should have. But he essentially said, you know, that's not how I would do it, or how other people I play with would do it. But okay. And so correct me if I'm wrong, I'm pretty sure he conceded there.
He did.
But they kept playing. And so good on him for continuing to play and conceding. It's crazy, right? Because of limited warfare. I mean, he conceded to make a point. And there have been points where people have committed to action, understanding that they were going to lose anyways. 1973, the Arab-Israeli war, Egypt committed to the conflict with the understanding that it might not be successful, and really with a strategic objective otherwise, right? And so I'm not trying to draw too many parallels to that, but I do think that there's something to that in conceding but still going, with understanding that you're sending a message. And the other player, the person who I would argue in this point kind of went total war on the war game, was very poorly received from the world of 40K that was watching. And it made quite a, I'd say, a dent in the actions that he conducted and how he conducted himself and what it meant to the 40K community as a whole. And then especially when you go into the follow-on game, and this should be definitely something that could go into it, is because he won that game, he goes into the final game, and then he makes almost a similar mistake himself, and his opponent turned and said, well, you know, I probably would have let you take that back, but because of your last game, I'm not going to let you take that back.
So I don't want to get us too far off the mark here with the point is that things that operate within the confines of the game, the strategy of your army, of how your army plays, you know, what's some of the unique things about your army and deploying them in a way, and deploying the tactics and deploying the stratagems and the abilities of your things are not gotcha moments.
I said about the GSC, just doing what your army is supposed to be doing is not a gotcha moment. And as much as it might feel like it to, you know, somebody who's never had those experiences or those things, it's not something we can deem as a gotcha moment anymore. The game is just that complex that either at that point everything is or isn't a gotcha moment. And I don't think that's a place where we don't want to live in a or play in a game that's that black and white.
Well, I love how Red, you related it to Limited and Total War, and we're very much playing in Limited War, a simulation, an abstraction, or whatever. But it's not always completely limited, I guess. You know, you've got some right. You can yeah. still I mean, tricks, and it's all fine. Yeah,
right. There's nothing saying that. I mean, again, a lot of Napoleon's maneuvers, and you're talking. You know, he fought several coalitions of other forces, and where a lot of cases he achieved maneuver to such a high degree that he really had won the field before anyone else knew it. And so there's something to the game that I think can be appreciated without being looked down upon as gotcha moments. In a lot of cases, I do think if you're on the receiving end of it, a lot of times I do think that sometimes it can be hard to swallow that exact issue. But there is a lot to taking it as a learning experience, acknowledging that you got outplayed, and then putting yourself back in the game and figuring out how you're going to overcome that and get back to it next time.
Yeah, and if you perceive a gotcha moment as something that you are unaware of, as in like they had a piece of war gear that operated in a way you didn't see, or a stratagem you weren't kind of cognitive for planning for, that's just an opportunity for growth that may or may not decide the battle. But here's the great thing about our game: that doesn't result in your death. You get to go home and think about it and change and plan for the future. You know, there's no scorched earth policy, you know, being enacted upon your country because you didn't foresee this possible occurrence, or you didn't, you know, predict your opponent. Now, one thing that Red said that's quite interesting, and this is a thing that is totally different from our experiences in war games, maybe to more often than not. How often do two parties engage in warfare and both believe they have the same chance of success? Because that is something that is pretty exclusive to what we do. A lot of people go into tournament games. A lot of people go and play garage games, coming in thinking they have a reasonably equal amount of opportunities for success. Which and that may not be the reality. You know, people see things differently, or, you know, you're playing an old book versus a new book, et cetera, et cetera. But how often in real life is that something that occurs?
I mean, that's a great question in cases that, because there's no point values, right? We don't get to walk in and say, well, you can only bring 2,000 points to this game, and I'm only going to bring 2,000 points.
Cruise missiles not allowed at this one.
right. Yeah. And so you really got to look into it. I mean, there actually is a system, and I think I've mentioned it before in the background, correlation of force matrix. And there's a lot of people out there that if they know what I just said, they're either laughing at me or they're rolling their eyes, which I totally understand. But it's the ability to essentially take certain factors of a battlefield and put it into something of a formula to be able to relatively compare forces against one another. And there's so many other factors that can go into it, such as morale or logistical support or however they're far. So like a tank might rate as like a 1.8, whereas an infantry platoon rates as like a 0.7 or something like that. And then there's multipliers and so on and so forth. It's just a system, an approach, a model to how you might do something like what we look at with 2,000 points versus 2,000 points. Now, in what case do you really have that? I mean, so a great concept to that is the Schlieffen plan, which was in World War One. Right. And so the Prussians and later the Germans had built their general staff to such an extent that they believed they had encapsulated these operational maneuvers, these massive plans through operational science, and built it together that they could accomplish certain things. And so the entire objective being, right, to essentially that they could force France to surrender by maneuvering so quickly. And that they could take, because right, the Germans had a problem that they had France and Russia on either front. And so they believed with the Schlieffen plan, which was meticulously calculated, meticulously worked out, that they could do this, and they would have the forces available to beat the French so quickly that they then could turn and defend themselves against the Russian and do it successfully. The problem is that they assumed that they had to have upwards of 70 divisions going 70 divisions, right? That's a massive number of people going from into France with approximately 20. So don't quote me on the exact numbers. I apologize. You can probably easily look it up. But approximately 20 divisions in the east to deal with Russia. So they were going to crush the west in France. But the reality ended up coming down to it that they actually only had a fraction of that available. And so they hoped and planned that they were going to – it's like, okay, I'm going to go into an army or I'm going to go into a game with 4,000 points versus the French with 1,500 points and the Russians with 2,000 points. So technically, I still have a 500-point advantage or whatever they thought, but I'm going to – go this way and then do this and it's going to be successful. But what they didn't account for, and we talk about, you know, discovery learning in games of not understanding things or not accounting for certain context, the Germans didn't account for the British. They didn't account that, you know, they had to travel through Belgium
who resisted and yeah,
exactly. And so there's all these other problems that they didn't resist. I mean, one of their division commanders, German division, Kluck, his name was Kluck. He was within sight of Paris, but decided to turn away from it. And so again, so much friction can occur with humans involved in this scope of conflict. But getting to your point about, you know, going into it with the same amount of points, I think there have been only so many cases where you've seen force on force of equal ratios. I think,
yeah,
it's always been an understanding of trying to jive for some kind of advantage. And that's where the war game gets so interesting, because the correlation of force matrix. So, I mean, the army says, you know, we're not with it or whatnot, but we really do, when we look at things, a very simple equation is, okay, if we're attacking something, we want a 3-to-1 advantage. Now, how we accomplish that 3-to-1 advantage might not be exact numbers. It might be achieved through effects. You know, different functions that we execute to try and force that advantage by disabling the enemy to a certain extent, right? And so there's a lot that goes into that. We rarely want to go into something with a 1-to-1 kind of deal, and that almost leads into stalemates and deterrence by doing that. So there's a whole other aspect to that.
Let's take a break. We're a bit on our segment, but I think that's a very interesting discussion, guys. And we may come back and continue that.
Yeah, I mean, this is it's crazy deep when you want to get into it. So yeah, absolutely. We could come back to it. We could dodge it. We could leave it for another week.
Hang on a minute, guys. See you in a minute.
FTN is brought to you by Discount Games Inc. Please visit them at www.discountgamesinc.com. And don't forget to ask Jay about ways to save even more on your hobby projects.
Hey everybody, we are back. That's a great topic. We're going to revisit that just a bit in the future. A little, you know, maybe dice it up into some bite-sized chunks.
Yeah. Thanks for asking. Yeah. I appreciate it.
It's a wily one that I, you know, conjured up in a moment of, I don't know, spacing out in the shower.
Shower so, thoughts.
If it didn't land with or it doesn't resonate with you, my apologies. I took it on a tangent.
Oh,
no, but
okay, go ahead.
Real quick. Sorry. Jump. I mean, total jump from that. I got to say, I received all my Gaunt's Ghost stuff. I got it all in. I am super excited for everything. That's closing out from that, you know, last time when I talked about trying my troubles of ordering it. I'm so happy I got the models. I can't wait to get them together. I've got the collector's edition of the Sabbat War deal. It's a crazy thing. It's signed by Dan Abnett, which is just amazing. I didn't even know it was going to be signed. And the material that's in it and the I'm looking at it right now, so I don't mispronounce it, the Vincula Insurgency. And what really, like, really gets me going about this is Ghost Dossier 1. And for anybody that gets this, I highly recommend the opening bit by Dan Abnett. Is just amazing. Like, I'm so excited for this stuff. I'm sorry, I just had to gush about that for a second before we continue into more 40K.
Man, I completely understand.
Don't be sorry.
Those are things to behold. I mean, they've done such a... If you have the means and it's something that you're there for it or whatever, you will never be disappointed in getting some of these collectible things.
Mm. Yeah, I totally agree. I did the same thing with the Luther and the Lion Primarch novels when they came out. I bought all the collector stuff. Zero regrets.
Mm. Yeah, I'm with you. So I do want to talk about testing for upcoming events and that kind of stuff, which has led me thinking about the Games Workshop events that are coming up. And they've published a tournament pack, and that has kind of their preferred, or what you will expect to see on the tables diagrammed. And of course, we get to see a kind of different terrain layout than maybe we're used to seeing in some of these events that are still kind of built for the previous edition.
It's an interesting one, and it's garnered a lot of attention, naturally, because this is the first kind of input GW has had on how they want competitive events played since, 2006, 2007, maybe 2010, 2011, if I'm a little behind the eight ball. But when was the last time GW ran a large competitive event, guys?
Oh, it's been a bit. Yeah, it's been a bit. But
yeah. I mean, they've had the Warhammer Worlds deal, right? And so
that's true.
Do those not count?
They actually do count, but this is one abroad. And that was the weirdest, or I should say one of the most interesting things is going over there and finding out they have like large events. They were every other weekend or so is what it felt like. It's kind of neat, but this is something, you know, on the US Roadshow, large tournaments for both Age of Sigmar and Warhammer 40,000. And, you know, we've often talked, you know, like one of the things of how the Drakari have thrived or whatever is kind of binary pass-fail terrain. And now we're going to see these ruins come into play where with windows and stuff. So if you're not in it or not touching the terrain, obscuring, because the keywords are there, they've listed the keywords. But if you get up and touch it or get in it, then you can see out of and be seen in. And that creates a slightly different dynamic than what we've seen, or maybe what people might be expecting.
Just off the cuff, are these the tables that you've seen, the ones demonstrated, the ones that have been given as examples, are these the same densities, the ones you guys play on? Are they more? Are they less? Are they bigger? Are they smaller?
I think the density is pretty similar, but the function is different.
I generally, my tables generally have maybe one or two pieces, either more or less, but all the pieces are generally larger, like either vertically or footprint wise. I do notice that there was an example photo that got chucked up on one of the Facebook pages, that I think it's the Competitive 40K Facebook page, of an example table, and I had Perspex on the bottom of the terrain pieces to give their spheres of influence, which is something I think is pretty clever. I think it's pretty cute. And so I'm keen to see how that has an impact as well. But yeah, generally, the only things I really thought was like, oh yeah, it's got the right amount of pieces on the table, but some of them aren't, maybe not as big as what we're used to.
So I don't know. I'll start with your last point, Adam. I think some of those squares are really big. I think that especially if those pieces are obstructing, I think that they block a lot of line of sight. If you look at, if you consider the entire area that they cover, if you're on the other side of it, those things block quite a bit of line of sight, right?
Yeah. Well, it's the obscuring keyword.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I mean, does the entire Perspex square have the obscuring keyword, or is it just the actual physical terrain pieces? Yeah. Like you see a lot of things, and this is on tables that I've been seeing ever since I've been playing the game, you'll see what something is actually built to be the foundations of a ruin, as in it's like a square. And you'll have a piece in one corner and then a larger piece in another corner, or vice versa, or equal size. I never actually had it defined to me. Am I supposed to be able to shoot through it down the middle of it? Am I supposed to be able to not shoot down the middle of it? If there is a guy standing there, you know, he's literally 2 inches from each actual piece of terrain, is that guy obscured? I've always played it that he... Well, I've pretty much left it up to interpretation. I've played it both ways, but I've assumed that I'm supposed to be able to see that dude.
Well, don't guess on that. I mean, you're
exactly. I could be wrong.
The event is, yeah. I mean, you're basically, you need to ask that kind of question if that kind of stuff comes up, or if that's what some of the things you're concerned with. You know, I typically play the base. The whole base gets their rules of the terrain.
Right. As a TO or as a player, more so as a TO, I find it much easier to just do exactly what you said, Paul. The whole base is obscuring, roll with it, because then you're not sitting there trying to determine, you know, like Adam, I'm sure that was a great situation you brought up. I'm sure there are a bajillion more of, well, is this guy partially covered by this? And where do we actually start drawing the line? And where does true line of sight? Well, it's, in my opinion, it's pretty clear if you go with the base, and then if you go inside that base, suddenly you become visible. But per obscuring, if you are outside the base and you can't see, like, it's very clear, in my opinion. I really think that that's better in a much more simpler approach, and can just, if you go with that, I think it creates a better game for folks with the flow and less consternation over it. I do think so. My other point I wanted to go with was the density. I think this is probably the minimal amount of terrain that I personally would want to see. I do like terrain. I do like how open some of these pieces are. You know, they're not blocked off to the extent that a vehicle couldn't get in them, or take a bloodthirster, for example, if I was going to go with my typical standard. Right, just hypothetically. I do think that there's something to that, and I do. Because I'm looking at one of these pictures and I see a blank corner that's probably, from even the corner of the mat all the way out to where the three pieces of terrain, I just feel like it's too empty to a certain degree, especially given some of the different deployments, that I would not prefer that for as a TO, like setting up a table for someone. I would like a little bit more there, even if it was just another obstructing piece there, another wall.
These can be found on the MetaWatch article most recently up on the Warhammer community page. You can see that the description. I may put one in the show notes too, a picture of one of the terrains.
I think I'm growing into this opinion. This wasn't my opinion at the start of 9th edition, but I'm growing into it. I don't really mind what the terrain is, as long as there is some. I just like knowing what it is before I rock up. I think the fact is that I believe what GW is skewing us towards with their army releases and the way codexes are going, and I've said this before on this show, all armies seem to be built to play in numerous different ways. Each army is getting a horde option in these 20-man troop units. Each one is getting an MSU option in, just speaking about AdMech, Rustalkers, Infiltrators, all the Electro Priests, Breachers, Castellan Robots, all being very viable, et cetera, et cetera. And so it feels like all the armies are getting quite well-rounded. And I think that leans us to being like, hey, well, we don't need to always have 12 pieces of terrain on every table. We just need to know what to build for beforehand, because all our armies can do all these different things. And I think that's very encouraging for people to go out and don't just have one 2,000 point army for XYZ faction, have 4,000, 5,000, 6,000, which probably feels better for GW as well. And also I can tell you, right, for me it's a very worthwhile thing, and I find it very comforting to know I've got 10,000 points of guard and I can just play whichever guard army I want.
Well, so not every tournament is going to have the benefit of being able to maybe publish their every single terrain layout like this, but I think it is fair to expect that when we are doing our testing and maybe army construction, and or if we're interested in maybe future-proofing our army, that we do use the keywords that are presented in the main rulebook.
Yeah, I'll make use of a wide variety of keywords. That's a very good idea if we're talking about practice.
Yeah, and that's what I want to link it to is how we're gearing up for these things, playtesting your list, maybe factoring into the units that you take, things that, I mean, how often have we sort of laughed when something ignored cover, the benefits of cover?
Yeah, sure. That's fair.
Maybe not so much now, but that used to be something that we did. Things that we've potentially written off as viable list options as we hunger and strive for ultimate efficiency. Does seeing something like this affect maybe how you would approach your army list design?
Yeah, it does. It really influences what I want to take and what I don't want to take. And that's why I said talking about it beforehand. I suppose this can be something that Red can maybe expand upon. Like, usually you know what the battlefield is going to be before you go into a battle. So you know that, we're fighting in a swamp. Don't bring the heavy tanks, etc.
Absolutely. I mean, and I think, tying it from that to the game, like always understanding what terrain does and how it impacts the game, and then understanding how it's interpreted as such a big deal, taking it into the game, knowing what you're looking at and how the TO and the event organizer, the people that are literally setting the standard for the event. It's so important to understand what you're going in there with, because, if it is dense terrain or not, so that was something that caught me off guard with looking at some of the things. I have seen people, there's kind of a general agreement with the game, and that, okay, we're going to take ruins from the rule book and we're going to use exactly as they're listed in the rule book, right? They are obscuring, they are light cover, they are heavy cover, they are so on and so forth, right? They are breachable, keep going. But then I've seen some events where there's been tweaks, and I don't think there's necessarily a problem with that. But I do think we go back to our very earlier topic in regards of discovery learning. You're going to find out real quick, and there are other people that are going to take advantage of it. And if you're not doing that, and your list was designed without that, without terrain in mind, you're definitely going to suffer. And so I think it's very important, to Paul's point, to discuss that, and to Adam's point, to understand what you have in relation to the terrain you're going to be fighting in.
Yeah, 100% agree. And so I played against, I think we were going to touch on this. I played against AdMech on the weekend, my first game against AdMech, and this guy brought all the guns. Like, he was just like, ah, oh, how many guns can I take? Turns out it's all of them. Guess that's what I'm doing.
Lots of zap.
Yeah, so it was what, two Onagers, two Disintegrators. I think it was 7 or 8 chickens. So it was just literally any, whatever he could see was just dead. On top of that, he had two bombers. And so, yeah, it was a rough day at the office. I ended up getting up because the gentleman didn't have any counter-assault units. And because I went back to 8th edition and started wrapping and trapping everything I could. And I had that cheeky Black Templar stratagem for, you know, pay 2 CP, 2 plus, you can't fall back. Did roll a 1 in a different game.
I will say,
one,
taking really Templars sucked into AdMech is kind of ballsy as it is, yep.
Yeah, well, I was just being like, is he going to Overwatch? Is he just going to Overwatch, you know, with chickens and I just lose half the squad? Because I had a bunch of aggressors and stuff like that. You know, high value targets just copping min 4 damage and dying. Felt pretty bad. But and that was because I had a table with decent terrain. I was able to hug some angles, not let him use all the guns at once, because naturally, if that guy could have shot me with every gun he had turn one, I would have just lost the game. And so it's really important, especially in this edition. I think the lethality of the game is on the rise, but this is the best terrain rules we've had in, I don't know, as a 5th edition, 6th edition, the terrain rules were pretty meh. 7th edition, they were very confusing. 8th edition, they were non-existent. So yeah, it might have been a decade since we had terrain rules that are this good. Or maybe never.
Well, I mean, I've liked rules in the past. I think that they fit with there. I think there have been a nice meld in some editions past with the complexity of the game, with the complexity of the rules at the time. And some things you could definitely tell, like the assault phase with initiative, that some terrain features were definitely designed to equal that out. And yeah, if you were able to utilize that, you always felt good. You felt like you really played into the system and got an advantage where maybe you had none or would be completely outclassed before.
Just putting it out there, has anybody remembered to use Defensible yet? I have not remembered to use Defensible once.
No, sir.
No. Red? Never mind. I completely forget to use Defensible every time. But yeah, I mean, I love obscuring, but I'm of the opinion not everything should be. And I feel like there may be too much of it on tables at the moment. And a lot of ones that I play has like 6 pieces of obscuring terrain. And I think, well, on the terrain pieces I'm playing on that are usually like these 3-story Ls, that's too many. It's too many. It's too much of the actual physical board.
What we're used to before, and I don't want to talk about necessarily just all terrain, but you know, there's the things that, you know, they don't know, no windows and that kind of stuff. And so you don't get a lot of the functionality and interaction that I think that the system is set up for. But I like what, you know, back you're talking about this thing about the AdMech, is that I assume that you were both maybe testing out list. I don't know if this is your proven, absolutely wrung out for efficiency Black Templars list, or if that was the same with the AdMech, or were they going into a situation like, I would like to play against something that's heavy assault?
Yeah. Well, so this gentleman, he was playing, you know, I think he's on his 4th game of the new Codex. And this is I've been playing Marines, I've been playing Black Templars, but the list I took is very close to something I'd take to a GT. So pretty sure he was on his first couple of games, and I'm on like I've played like 2 games of non-Marines this edition, so I'm probably on to my like 50 or 60th game with Marines versus this guy playing his 3rd or 4th game with the AdMech book. So yeah, not the outcome on those terms aren't surprising. I mean, the power differential between the armies was, oh dude, those chicken walkers, I can see why you got 6 of them. every single time they could see something, even if there's only like 2 of them in a squad, they just killed whoever they shot. It was like, I can see it, you're dead. This guy can see it, you're dead. And man, they book it. Those chicken legs, they cover a lot of space. I'm like, they're kind of like, an ostrich. I'm putting it out there. Or an emu, you know, those long legs, you know, high top speed. Because, man, they go 16 inches and shoot without penalty around those corners. And it's just like there's very few ways to truly stop them from getting angles
there
when
is
they're
no
really
escape.
Desperate about it. Yeah, there's no escape. They are fearsome, man. Absolutely fearsome.
Yeah. So what was the – do you think that – now, going into this list, I mean, the likelihood of let's take this as in a playtest situation. Is the likelihood, I think, of your opponent encountering a Black Templar's list in the mission that you played with you piling in a tournament is maybe unlikely.
On the table. Yeah.
So what do you think the takeaways from that type of game? What do you think that he could take, even though that situation is unlikely, what are still some of the takeaways that your opponent could utilize that maybe influences their next choices?
Well, it is just basic tenets of ninth edition. You want OBSEC, you want numerous amounts of OBSEC. You can't, or either that, or you want to play an army that is extremely good at removing OBSEC. And you want different modes of play. You don't want to just be restricted to playing and I suppose this is one of the reasons Tower's held back. They're restricted to playing two phases of the game. This gentleman's Admech army was restricted to playing two phases of the game because it didn't have any combat units. I'm not saying you need to go and spend, you know, a quarter or half your army on combat units. You just need one good one to make your opponent be, you know, play honest 40k with you and not just try and bully in one aspect or one phase. Because I pretty much I didn't play much of a shooting phase. I shot my Redemptor Dreadnoughts when I thought they wouldn't die when they could shoot a target. And apart from that, I just played the charge in the assault phase. And yeah, it worked out in my benefit. And I think that's the difference. If that we talked about it after the game. It's a great, great guy. His name's Reese. Plays a local of Geelong, a town about an hour away from me. Great guy. He's very much going to be a dude who's going to be smashing it on the top tables very shortly. If he just had one decent close combat unit, just one, could have been infiltrators, could have been electro priests, could have been Castellan robots, to keep me honest and not and make me pause when committing and just like bull rushing him. And trying to wrap and trap everything. That would have been all the difference. Absolutely all the difference. And so it's just some basic tenets of where 9th edition is going. What's it coalesced to? You need to have an army that can play multiple phases of the game. Like, and it doesn't have to be all of them, but you've got to be good at about two of them. Either you've got to be quick and shooty, quick and durable, you know, fighty and durable, fighty and quick, and then be able to have some play in the rest. Red will probably speak to this just as well as everything. Like, you don't want to just have infantry, you know, on a battlefield. You don't want to just have artillery, etc. Even yourself, it's one of the hang-ups, I think, maybe the reason why you're playing Admech right now, not Blood Angels. Blood Angels are having some of those issues themselves.
Blood Angels struggle a bit with the tempo, and that's the wrong area where they want to be. But I've learned that Admech is, I mean, it's powerful. They're also really cool looking. I can't deny that. But what I found in my list, and what's actually in my list right now, is I am packing the Castellan robots, like we talked about.
How are they going for you?
I love them because they move faster than maybe they look with their appearance, and they can punch like freight trains. And so, like you were talking about, you know, playing quote unquote honest 40K, is that if someone tries to rush in on you with what could be deadly to your minimal armor saves, low toughness, you know, you've things that go into you very, very, very well, even with strength 4, things go into you pretty well. If they have even the most basic rend, you're basically picking up models, and that does not happen against a Castellan robot. And the Castellan robot, even though they're, you know, they're yesterday's army list component, I think that they really fit well. They don't compromise your shooting very much.
Are you taking double fist or one fist, one gun? Are you taking the flamer or the phosphor on the shoulder? What's your layout?
The phosphor on the shoulder and then one fist, one gun is what I've typically been doing.
Nice.
Yeah. And it's just enough to where, you know, are they the perfect unit every time? No, but I think they're very well optimized for a situation like you're describing. Now, I don't think I lucked into that. I went into it with how I approach things. Like, what if a bunch of Sanguinary Guard just decided to run in there and set up shop? Would there be anything that made them question that? And I kept coming back to this Castellan robot profile. I wasn't so attracted to the robot itself, although it is Again, great model. Love it. Happened to have already had some, but the profile seemed to fit what I thought I might need in at least half the games that I played.
You mean that defensively, as in it won't just keel over the first time a dedicated melee unit just looks at it?
That's it. Or enough to make, I think if you had 10 assault intercessors, you would probably question whether or not you wanted to run into two or three Castellan robots. And having three or four Castellan robots on my side, they make you put in game theory, they make you question what the perfect decision is.
Yeah, and they're at that weird profile of different, you know, high defense, high toughness, good save, you know, invuln save, etc. Where they just question what the math actually is to remove them, what the investment is to get rid of them. And I think that's the question you want to ask. If you can't put in something that's going to remove them wholesale, you don't really bother in 9th edition. Well, that's what I'm finding in 9th edition from the way I play the game. I do like taking them with things like chickens because they have a very similar defensive profile, and the fact that you need the same things to kill the chickens as you need to kill the Castellan robots, and chances are one of them is going to get away scot-free from that exchange and go on a bit of a rampage. I do love that you actually take them with the different guns because it means they're not overwhelming in every facet, in every part of the game, but you don't need that from AdMech. AdMech already has overwhelming shooting, has great maneuverability. They're just like the pinch hitter. They pinch hit in all the different phases. I love that.
And not to limit this just to AdMech, you know, I look at this when I'm entering any kind of armor. It's like guard, you know, it's do I want a bunch of snipers because I have problems digging characters out? Yeah, those are the types of things that I look at when I'm going through my list. It's like what bit of efficiency do you sacrifice for utility if your aim is to win a bunch of games?
And I suppose this comes back to practice. Yeah, what are you practicing for? What's really, you know, your drive? What's your goal? What are you doing? How do you practice if you get many practice games in? Are you a guy who'll, you know, schedule a day's practice, or will you just have one pickup game a week or when you can?
Yeah, no. So when it comes to practice, I mean, I only think theory crafting. I think we've talked about this some. You know, you talked about theory crafting or theory hammer in a vacuum, right, Paul? And I think that kind of conversation is good and can be quite an enjoyable discussion between friends and whatnot, or competitive, you know, however you want to go about it in a forum. But I do think that practice is essential, and therefore, I mean, after my move, I haven't had an opportunity yet, but before and throughout our little bout of COVID and everybody managing what they can with what they had available, I was able to still play games where I could. And I'll admit that just being able to see mechanics play out here or there helps me a lot, right? I'm not saying that it kept me at my most competitive edge. I do think that iron sharpens iron. So I do think that there's something to being able to play more difficult and engaging games can really help push you and in my case, really me, to a better degree of sportsmanship and my capacity to play. However, in a lot of cases, given the current environment and what we were dealing with over the last year, my practice a lot was mostly, fortunately, I still enjoyed myself quite a bit, was through Crusade games. A lot of that was mostly 1,000 points, sometimes 2,000 points. And I do try to kind of figure out a core that I can stick to and play through. And with that, I do try to bounce around a little bit into maybe change a variation here or there. Sometimes in very rare cases, I'll just pull out something completely different, completely unorthodox from what I might have thought, just to see how it goes. And that's honestly, I've been able to find some very interesting combos for myself and the play styles therein. And I've also been fortunate to play against a wide variety of folks throughout a community that have been able to entertain quite a bit of my indulgences, I guess you could say. But yeah, that's kind of how I go about practicing. But I do think we've talked about some of the competitive formats, understanding the format, understanding the environment. And I think that you train as you fight like you train. That's a very army thing to say. If you're training or practicing for something specific, you should just play in that format and environment to get your mind the habit down as you're playing to it. But yeah, that's me in practicing.
Yeah, I think we're out of time this week. This has been some great topics, and I've, no doubt we will continue to cover some of these things and expand. I want to hear what people think. So if there's some things you're doing in testing that's been working out that you weren't expecting, if you are planning for scenarios and terrain features that maybe you haven't had a lot of experience with, let's hear about it.
Awesome.
Yeah. Thanks for indulging me, guys.
Oh, that was a great discussion. Yeah, we'll see y'all next week.
Take care.
Good night.
Tenets demand you tune in next week for the greater good, of course.